evening, everyone. You can see my title up here. It's the Death of Kings. You know, when you look at the world today, and especially kind of in our culture here, you know, they throw around this term quite a bit, you know, like, and they refer to people as, you know, kings and queens. And it's a title we throw around quite often. And matter of fact, there's a barbershop that's up here. It's called King's Barbershop. It's a barbershop I go to. But it's just a common thing to see, you know, and you see that people usually they refer to themselves or refer to other people as a king or a queen, you know, something of royalty, something that has value. And usually it's coupled with, hey, you didn't know your value, you know, king, know your value, queen. And, you know, I wanted to talk about that. I heard some things that got me thinking about this and, you know, kings and queens, you know, they don't always last. So there's a piece of a poem we're going to start off with, just a section of it. And it's a poem by Percy Shelley. And it was written a while ago, I want to say about in the 1800s, I think. But it's called Ozymandias. And so the piece of that poem that I'm going to start off with is, you know, my name is Ozymandias. King of kings, look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. You know, this poem was written by Percy Shelley. He was a poet, lived back in those times, around the 1800s, early 1800s, I think. And he wrote this poem because it was about a statue. And Ozymandias is the Greek name for Pharaoh, Ramses II. So he wrote this poem about a statue that Ramses II had made of himself. And it was this very large statue. And I believe it's a real statue. It was excavated from Egypt, and I think it was taken back to Europe. I think it's currently in the London Royal Museum or something like that. So it was in Italy for a while, and then it's in London now. But it was this giant statue. And when it was complete and it was whole, it was 57 feet tall. It's a big, big statue that Ramses had commissioned so he could, you know, aggrandize himself. And he looked... That's what he did. He said, look at my stuff. Look what I've done. Look at my worth. Look at my value. You know, all you mighty people out there, look at me. Look what I've done. Of course, he is no longer with us today. And so we'll get to the rest of that poem in a little bit. But I want to talk about some kings that are in our scriptures. And the first one I want to talk about is in Acts in the 12th chapter. This is about King Herod. There were several King Herods in the New Testament, and so this, I forget this particular Herod. His Herod is kind of a title, sort of like president, but they call him King or Herod the King. So it's like, you know, the leader of the king or something. It's kind of a general title. But this particular one was not the one that was chasing Jesus, but it was in that same family line, I believe. And so we look in Acts in the 12th chapter. Start off with the first verse. Now about that time, Herod the king stretched forth his hand to vex certain of the church. And he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. And because he saw it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to take Peter also. Then were the days of the unleavened bread. And when he had apprehended him, he put him in prison and delivered him to the four, quaternions. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. But he delivered him to a group of soldiers to keep him, intending after Easter to bring him forth to the people. So, we see here that Herod, he's starting to vex certain people. He's vexing the leaders, the apostles at the time. He kills one of them, and then he sees, like, hey, my people really enjoy this, so go grab me that guy. And he goes and grabs Peter. And they take Peter, and they go and shove him in a prison. And so, it was getting ready to be Passover, and so they were like, well, we don't want to, like, kill people on Passover, so just take him over here, hold him, and we'll deal with him later. And naturally, you know, Peter's in prison. The people there began to pray for him, and as he was in prison, because it was like Adam was describing this morning, he described a prison break this morning, and he described that prison. You can imagine this prison is probably the same way that Adam described. It's not a nice place to be. And Peter was in there. Continuing on, verse 5, Peter was therefore kept in prison, but prayer was made without ceasing of the church unto God for him. So he was being prayed for. As people knew, hey, his condition. And the church began to pray for him. And when Herod would have brought him forth, the same night Peter was sleeping between two soldiers bound with two chains, and the keepers before the door kept the prison. So he's in chains, and he's between two soldiers. They really don't want Peter to get away. They put him right next to soldiers. They put him in chains. They put him behind walls. They put him under guard. Verse 7, and behold, the angel of the Lord came upon him, and a light shined in the prison, and he smote Peter on the side and raised him up, saying, arise quickly. And his chains fell off from his hand. The angel said unto him, gird thyself, bind on thy sandals. And so he did. And he said unto him, cast thy garment about thee and follow me. So this angel comes in. It kind of reminds me of like when my kids were younger, I'm trying to get them up. Like, come on, get up. Let's go. Get your clothes on. Get your shoes on. Let's go. Follow me. Let's go. Let's go. It's kind of what it reminded me of. Getting slapped awake by an angel. Getting told to get your clothes on in the middle of the night. And the chains are falling off. And so Peter gets out. And at first he thinks it's a vision or something like that, and he says, you know, he follows the angel, and as soon as he exits the prison, the angel goes away. And he realized that was an angel of the Lord. And so now he's fugitive from the king. So he decides, all right, well, I'm going to go, and I'm going to go where people know me. So he then goes to, we'll read it here. Come to the 12th verse. When he had considered a thing, he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark, where many were gathered together praying. So there were a group of people that were praying for him. And Peter knocked on the door, the gate. A damsel came to hearken, named Rhoda. And when she knew Peter's voice, she opened not the gate for gladness, but ran in and told how Peter stood before the gate. And they said unto her, thou art mad. But she constantly affirmed that it was even so. And they said, it is his angel. You know, it's kind of this funny scene here. When you think about it, he goes and he's fugitive from justice, or not justice, but fugitive from the king. And he goes and goes to the place where he knows he's going to be safe. He knocks on the door, and poor Rhoda here is so happy she doesn't open the door. She runs and tells everybody, and then nobody believes her. And it's kind of this little comedy. Here's Peter outside, you know, knocking on the door. Let me in. I'm fugitive. Hey, Peter's outside. No, you're crazy. You're crazy. Well, eventually he keeps knocking. He keeps knocking, and they go and they see him, and they're all astonished. Hey, it's Peter. He's actually here. And so, continuing on, back at the prison, now, in the verse 18, now as soon as it was day, there was no small stir among the soldiers. What was become of Peter? So, this is a big deal. You can imagine, we put Peter under guard, in a locked room, in chains, with guards on either side of him. And they wake up, and he's gone. How can that be? And so I'm sure they're worried, because the king was the one that said, hey, you need to watch this guy, because I have plans for him. Verse 19, when Herod had sought him and found him not, he examined the keepers and commanded that they should be put to death. And he went down from Judea to Caesarea, and there he abode. So he goes in. Peter's not there. He puts to death those people that were responsible. And then he goes to Caesarea. And so now the story kind of changes slightly here. Now Herod was highly displeased with them of Tyre and Sidon, but they came with one accord to him. So there's Tyre and Sidon, two different kingdoms. And he's upset with them for some reason. We don't know why. But these representatives come to him. And, having made Blastus, the king's chamberlain, their friend, desired peace, because their country was nourished by the king's country. And so, these two countries, they send the representatives, and they get a hold of someone who's close to the king, his chamberlain, whose name is Blastus. I would ask you young people out there, if you're considering having children, let's consider the name Blastus, because that could be a great name, or it could be a terrible name. I don't know, it depends on how the kid is. But, that could be an awesome name for somebody out there. Just throwing that out there as a side note. But anyway, this man, this chamberlain, he is close to the king. And they come to him, like, hey, we need to talk to him. We need to see him. We need to be in his presence. Because there's this exchange. He's supporting our country. You know, we have big deal here. This is big business that we've got to take care of. And he's displeased with us. We've got to make this right. So in verse 21, and upon a set day, Herod, arrayed in royal apparel, sat upon his throne, and made an oration to them. So they're allowed in. He's allowed to come in, and he speaks to them. And he's sitting in his royal robes and his in the court there. This is kind of an official thing. In verse 22, and the people gave a shout, saying, it is the voice of a god and not of a man. So they give him this praise. In verse 23, and immediately the angel of the Lord smote him, because he gave not God the glory. And he was eaten of worms and gave up the ghost. And so God was watching Herod. And I'm sure that Herod, if he's king of Judea or king of the Jews, he probably had access to the laws that they had. You know, the Ten Commandments. I shall have no other idols before me. I haven't talked about that this morning a little bit. You're not to have idols. You're not to have any other gods before me. I am your God. And here Herod took on, he accepted this praise. And he was out persecuting the church. And God said, too far. And the angel of the Lord smote him, took him away, killed this king. Now we're going to transition over to the Book of Mormon. We're going to find a very similar story about another king. Now it came to pass that Zenith conferred, this is in Mosiah in the 7th chapter. Now it came to pass that Zenith conferred the kingdom upon Noah, one of his sons. Therefore Noah began to reign in his stead. And he did not walk in the ways of his father. For behold, he did not keep the commandments of God, but he did walk after the desires of his own heart. And he had many wives and concubines. And he had caused his people to commit sin, to do that which was abominable in the sight of the Lord. And so he knew Noah, new king, takes over, and he's like, I'm going to go my own direction. Because who's going to stop me? I'm the king. So he begins to go his own direction. And he sets up this whole court where he has his own priests and he has his own advisors. And he, not only does he have many wives and concubines, he makes sure that they all have wives and concubines. And he makes them rich through taxes. And he taxes the people and takes their stuff so he can support this. And then he has these building projects. And he makes these vineyards. And he makes wine presses. And he makes wine. Skipping down to the 9th verse. Yea, and thus they were supported in their laziness, talking about the king and his court, and in their idolatry and in their whoredoms, by the taxes which King Noah had put upon his people. Thus did the people labor exceedingly to support iniquity. And you'd think to yourself, well, that doesn't, who would do that? Why would you do that? You know, leaders all throughout history have figured things out. They know how to control people. And in verse 10, yea, and they also became idolatrous, because they were deceived by the vain and flattering words of the king and priests, for they did speak flattering things into them. You know, they told them what they wanted them to hear. What they wanted to hear. They were hearing the things that they wanted to hear. Does it sound familiar? You know, people haven't changed a whole lot. We're going to have an election coming up. What are we being told? We're being told the things that we want to hear. We're being told, you know, fear this, fear that. Stirring people's hearts up. Hey, I've got the solution. I can help you. And that's what they've done here. Told these people, stirred them up, and offered themselves as the solution. And it came to pass that King Noah built many elegant and spacious buildings. And he ornamented them with fine work of wood and of all manner of precious things, of gold, silver, of iron, of brass, of ziph, and of copper. So he takes these taxes and he builds up the nation so it looks like something to be proud of. These people are building this up and they're willing to submit themselves because they're being told flattering things. They're being told it's okay. They're being told that they're a good people. Look at the works that you've done. The works the king has set forth. Now I'm taking all these taxes and I'm doing it for your good. Well, God could see this happening. And he did not want this to happen any further. So he sends in someone, a man named Abinadi, comes in, he prophesies, and he warns, you know, you're living in sin. You're not doing what's right by God. You and your people. Verse 40. Now when King Noah had heard of the words which Abinadi had spoken unto the people, he was also wroth, and saith, who is Abinadi, that I and my people should be judged of him? Or who is the Lord that shall bring upon my people such great afflictions? King Noah had a pretty high opinion of himself and his people. Who are you to tell me what to do? What gives you the right? What gives God the right to judge me and my people? Look at the things that we have. Look at the things we are. Look at what we've done. This can't be bad. Verse 42, I command you to bring Abinadi hither, that I may slay him, for he has said these things, that he might stir up my people to anger one with another and raise contentions among my people. Therefore, I will slay him. And then they speak lies. Lies about people who will bring the truth. You know, nothing's changed. People in power, you know, the kings of today, they will say and do what suits them, what keeps them in power. Here Noah wishes to stay in power, so he tells lies. You know, he's here to stir up my people, to cause contention. And that's not why he came. It's not why he was there, but he was had lies spoken about him. And so they capture him. They bring him in. I'm going to skip down a few verses, down to verse 107. And now he's in front of the court, and he's directly condemning Noah and his priests. Verse 107. And he spake with power and authority from God. And he continued his word, saying, you see that you have not power to slay me. Therefore, I finished my message. They had gone up to him. They were going to try and kill him. And he said, don't touch me. You touch me, you're going to die. And they backed off. And it says his face shone like Moses. So he had the power of God with him. And he tells and he finishes his message. Verse 108. Yea, and I perceive that it cuts you to your hearts, because I tell you the truth concerning your iniquities. Yea, my words fill you with wonder and amazement and with anger. But I finished my message, and that it matters not whither I go, if it be so that I am saved. But this much I tell you, what you do with me after this shall be as a type and a shadow of things which are to come. And so he finished his message. And if you read on in the story, they took him, they tied him to a stake, they set a fire about him, and they burned Abinadi. Right after he made this prophecy. And they had the power to do that. They had the authority given by themselves and their structure of government. We can do this. The king can do this. I can make a decision. I don't like this person. He's saying things I don't like. It's contrary to my system here. He's going to upset my system. Then they won't want to pay taxes. They won't want to do this. They'll break apart my government. I can't have that. I got to stay in power. So he takes Abinadi and executes him. Then you jump ahead in a few chapters. And in the following chapters, an invading army comes in. And Noah's people there, they begin to fight. And they end up kind of losing this battle here. But Noah manages to get away. And in the course of this, they took their wives and children, the priests and his advisors, they all kind of grouped together and they all took off and they fled and left their people behind. And look at chapter 9. And it came to pass the Lamanites did pursue them and overtake them and began to slay them. Now it came to pass that the king, which is King Noah, commanded them that all men should leave their wives and their children and flee before the Lamanites. And so they did. They took everybody and they took off. And they grabbed their wives, or they left their wives and children behind to their fate. And they left. Of course, they get out in the following verses, and the men are like, my wife and my children are back there. I want to go back. And King Noah said, no, we're not going back. And they didn't appreciate that much. So verse 96, the king commanded that they should not return. And they were angry with the king and the cause that he should suffer, even unto death by fire. So we have another king who died. Unable to fulfill his promises, unable to keep his statutes. Now these two kings, they had lots in common. One, they had pride in what they'd done. They were vaunting themselves. They were seeing that it was working with their people. Proud. So they went forth, took actions against God's leaders, God's people, God's church. They were doing this because it pleased people hey, I can keep my power, I can keep my base, I can keep my authority if I'm pleasing my people. So I'm willing to do and murder, torture, and imprison unjustly. And neither one of them were remorseful for what they'd done. They continued to live in their sin proudly. This also caused their people to sin. And they allowed it. They should have been a leader. They should have stopped their people from sin. It's hard being a leader. It's supposed to be the example for everyone. They set an example that the people followed, and they followed in sin. You know, they had warnings, which they decided not to listen to. And in the end, their lives were cut short. And when their lives were cut short, they lost everything they had. Everything they'd set up all came to nothing. So now we're going to go back to that poem here that I started off with, just a section of it. And I'll read it out loud. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast, trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert near them, on the sand. Half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read. So if you can kind of set that up, he's looking at a broken statue in the desert. Someone told him, hey, there's this old land over here. You should go check it out. There's this antique thing, this statue. But it's fallen over. There's just two legs sticking up out of the ground, and the rest of it has fallen next to it. Let's see. Which yet survives, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. So what this poet is saying is like, here's this man who made this claim, I am mighty. Look what I've done. Look at the things I've built. And when this point of view from the author here, it's in his wasteland, and it's broken. And that statement means nothing. That king is gone. He's no longer powerful. So you can see that in our scriptures, we have example of these earthly kings. They come and they gain power. You can see in history here, the kings, they come and they get power. And when they die, it's all gone. For them, it's gone. It means nothing. And as time goes by, it means nothing. And all is lost and consumed. So many times when there's a transfer of power, you know, when you look at European history, and you look at history of the Middle East, and these, you know, these kings and these leaders would change, and it was based on heredity, and I say that word. But it was based on, you know, their sons taking over. And sometimes they didn't have sons. And then whenever a king died, it was often the cause of war. Because one side would think, this is the rightful king. Another side would think, this is the rightful king. In the Ottoman Empire, they knew this would happen. And so in the Ottoman Empire, when the new king was named, the standard operating procedure was you go and you execute every other heir. Because they didn't want the war. It was going to tear apart their kingdom. Because sons and brothers and uncles would fight. And it would destroy the kingdom. So they would just go in, like, all right, you're the king. And everyone else either got out of town or got murdered. You know, because that's what kings of the earth do. They don't bring stability. They don't bring peace. So how did they get this way? Well, you know, if you go back, the very first chapter, the very first book, in Genesis, first chapter, verse 26. And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. So we're made in the image of God. We're made like a king. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. So he created us to be kings, to be leaders, to take dominion. You know, it's within us, it's written in our DNA. Verse 28, and God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. God said, behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed, which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in the which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for meat. To every beast of the earth, and every fowl of the air, to everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat. And it was so. He gave us everything and told us, you're going to conquer this. Subdue it. Make it yours. You know, it's in us to rule. But what happens when we don't have our guide? When we don't follow the Lord? You know, it relies on ourselves. You know, and we have this intellect, we have this ability to look at things and to be able to plan and to coordinate, and we can make a lot happen. We can use this earth, which is just this huge bounty and vast resources. And we look at it, and we can, some people are very good. They can make money and they can make power. I have a slide, I have a picture coming up. It may seem a little odd, but let me explain. Who knows what this is? Anybody seen this movie? There's a whole series of movies. It's the Marvel movies, a whole bunch of them. This was the last one I think they made. But if you look on that screen there, and there's all the characters that are in that film. You know, when you look at it, and you look at the whole series of films, you know, what are these people? What are they? You know, they have this power in various different forms. And you know, the kind of the underlying theme of the whole series is like, you know, hey, we're people and we can solve our problems. If we have enough intellect, if we have enough strength, if we have enough wit, if we have enough skill, if we have enough capability, we can solve our own problems. And so all of these people here, you know, these actors, they're, you know, this is all fake, but you know, the underlying theme is, you know, you can decide and you can use what's around you. You can be a king and solve the problems that you face. Using your technology, your power, your intellect, you can solve it through all manner of ways. You know, your righteous indignation, your righteous view, as long as you have it, you can solve these problems. Technology, talked about that a little bit this morning. You know, it can solve your problems. You know, it's a very man-made thing. And it's in us. And we use these things to rule. And that's what these kings did. They were able to look out, use their resources, use their power, their influence for themselves. But we have a better way, a different way. We're called to a different kingdom. We're called to serve a different king. If we go into James in the fourth chapter. But he giveth more grace, wherefore he said, God resisteth the proud, but give grace to the humble. And you look at that picture before, well, none of those people are very humble. Look in there, in those movies, and they're very proud, they're very capable, and they do these things. You know, none of them are very humble. But that's not what God's looking for. God is looking for humility. Verse 7. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. And there we are given power. Submit to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee. We have been given a power. Verse 8, draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh to you. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners. Purify your hearts, ye double-minded. Be afflicted and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to heaviness. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he shall lift you up. Now you come to the King, the one true King. You kneel before him, and he will lift you up. He will give you guidance. He will help you solve your problems. The Book of Mormon tells us the same. Mosiah, the first chapter, verse 118. But men drink damnation to their own souls, except they humble themselves and become as little children, and believe that salvation was and is to come in and through the atoning blood of Christ, the Lord omnipotent. For the natural man is an enemy to God, and has been from the fall of Adam, and will be forever and ever. You know, God gave us this charter when he was in the garden. He gave them that charter. This is what you're going to do. You're going to subdue this. Go into the earth. Go into the garden. It's yours. And you know, sin came in, and that charter didn't get recalled. What God said was, all right, you can no longer be here, so now it's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult. You still have the same charter, but it's going to be much, much harder. He tells Adam, you know, you're going to toil and sweat all the days of your life in order to make that happen. He tells Eve, you know, you're going to bear children, and it's not going to be pleasant. But we still have it written in us, you know, to go out and to conquer. And to be, you know, the captains of our own destiny. But God says, you know, humble, turn that over to him. Humble yourself, give your will to mine, and I will lift you up. We'll talk about another king. King Louis XIV. Just a few facts about him to set this up. He was the longest reigning European monarch. He reigned 72 years. I think he took the throne when he was 5 years old, when he ascended to the throne. He died just before his 77th birthday. So he reigned a very, very long time. And there was a change in his government. He took them, kind of transformed them from a feudal system to a more colonial system, which is not, they're both oppressive, so it's not good. But he transferred them from this old feudal system, which kind of kept them down. It doesn't work well for building up, you know, a nation. You know, everybody has their own little piece of the pie, and they're all kind of running their own thing. And the king doesn't have a whole lot of command. He has command, but not full command over everything. So he changed it over to this colonial system where, you know, they were able to consolidated everything, and they were able to go out, you know, and conquer other lands and take from other people. And because of that, made them very rich. You know, he built Versailles. He invested in the arts. And so if you look at a lot of French architecture and a lot of French art, and you go there, like the Louvre, a lot of that stuff changed when Louis XIV came on. Because he had a whole bunch of people that he supported, a bunch of artists and bunch of artisans, you know, architects and things, and he revamped it. And so when you look at a lot of French stuff, you can go back to Louis XIV. That's where it began, really. He called himself the Sun King. He believed he was directly representing God. Very proud. King Louis liked himself some King Louis. He had paintings of himself, and he would see he had these big, giant robes and the finest clothing and the furs. He lived in these opulent palaces, and his whole court was very opulent. It was most opulent in all of Europe at the time. And he thought pretty highly of himself. So he lived, you know, he reigned 72 years, and he got up. He died just like 5 days before his 77th birthday. And even in his funeral, he had it planned out. Because I'm the Sun King, and I am important, and I want everyone to look at me and realize what I was. And so, for his funeral, he had himself made a gold casket. and he put it on display. And he put himself on display after he died. He was last will and testament. You're going to put me in this casket. You're going to put me in the Notre Dame Cathedral. And you're going to allow everyone to come in that can and look at me. And I think for 8 days, they put him on display. And he told this to his royal chaplain, a man named Jean-Baptiste Massillon. I'm not really sure I'm a French there, but that was his chaplain. And he told his chaplain, this is what you're going to do for me. So his chaplain did this. He brought him, did the display, put him in Notre Dame. And one of the things was, he told him, he says, when you put me on display, you're going to put me in the chapel, and the only light that's allowed is going to be one candle right above my coffin so that everyone can focus on me. And so this priest or bishop, I'm not sure what he was, but he was the royal chaplain, he does that. Puts the candle, that one candle up in front of his coffin there, his golden coffin, and allows this to take place. And then it comes time to deliver the eulogy for King Louis. And this chaplain, it's in the chapel at Notre Dame, there's the one candle is burning there. He walks up to the candle. He snuffs it out, so it's dark. And this is the eulogy he gave. Only God is great. He snuffed out that light, that representation of the king. He is gone. Everything he's built is worth nothing now. It means nothing because he's dead. He can't take it with him. It's being dispersed to everyone else. Only God is great. He can say that because Christ is our King. He's the King who died, and it meant something. It carried on. He's the King, as it described in Moroni in the 7th chapter, why he was king. Verse 50, and if a man be meek and lowly in heart, and confess by the power of the Holy Ghost that Jesus is the Christ, he must needs have charity. For if he have not charity, he is nothing. Wherefore, he must needs have charity. Charity, the pure love of Christ. That's why Christ is the King of kings. Because he has charity. It gives this description. Verse 51, and charity suffereth long. When Christ was here and he was king, he suffered. He sacrificed his sleep. He sacrificed his free time for the betterment of his people. And is kind. He was kind to those that approached him. He was kind to the sinners who needed him. Envieth not. He wanted nothing that we had. He had it all. And what did he do with it? He promised he would give it to us. So I have mansions in heaven prepared for you. He's not puffed up. When he was here, who did he vaunt? He's my Father in heaven. He is greater. Seeketh not her own. He's in the garden praying. God, if there's another way, please let it be known. But not my will. Yours. He's not easily provoked. You know, when he was here, he was called a drunkard. He was called mad. He was called a liar. He was called a blasphemer. And he didn't take any anger against those people who called him. Thinketh no evil. You know, he wants nothing but good for all his creation. He doesn't look at someone and it's like, you know, I'm glad you're going to the other place, that you're not going to partake in my glory. He doesn't think that. It saddens him. Rejoiceth not in iniquity. You know, it pains him when we sin. Just as those nails went through his hands, feet, it hurts. But rejoices in the truth. You know, people would come to him. People that weren't from Israel, they would come to him and say, I have faith in you. He said, I will grant you what you want. Go, your loved one is healed. Because you believe in the truth. More than my own people. Beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. This is the King. He's not vaunting himself. Everything he did, everything he does, was for you and for me. Wherefore, my beloved brethren, if you have not charity, you are nothing, for charity never faileth. He claims the title, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, because he's purchased, he's sacrificed, he's given everything while he was here. Not like earthly kings. And when he left a foundation of peace, prosperity, an assurance of where we would go. It was his death that made the difference. And he can claim us. Verse 52, wherefore cleave unto charity, which is the greatest of all, for all things must fail, but charity is the pure love of Christ, and it endureth forever. Whoso is found possessive at the last day, it shall be well with them. Wherefore, my beloved brethren, pray unto the Father with all energy of heart that ye may be filled with this love, which he hath bestowed unto all who are true followers of his Son, Jesus Christ, that ye may become the sons of God, that when he shall appear, we shall be like him. For we shall see him as he is, that we may have this hope, that we may be purified, even as he is pure. It was through his death that we are given this promise. We can be like him one day. This King who came, was born in a stable, who walked on his own 2 feet. He didn't ride in chariots. He didn't build monuments. He just lived for you and I. This King who sacrificed himself. So I pray that you all serve the one true King, the God of gods, the Lord of lords, him who, when we see him in the end, we will one day be like him. Thank you for your time.